Hello and welcome. My name is Nicholas. I'm one of the pastors here at Fountain Springs, and I have the great privilege today of kind of wrapping up this series called, it's based on a sequence of clips from The Chosen, and I need to jump in right away because I've got a lot to talk about today, and I'm going to run out of time if I don't do this quickly. So today I want to talk to you about that short scene with Matthew and what it might mean for you. Because this is the question. What would it look like for you, regardless of what it is you do right now, what would it look like for you to leave your career behind and take up another career because Jesus is calling you? Think about that. What would it look like if you did that the way that Matthew did that? Never mind the fact that Matthew is a tax collector and, you know, they're people of ill repute in the first century. What would it look like for you? Now, Jesus calls disciples. He calls followers many times in the Gospels, and maybe we scan past them too quickly. And we don't pause to ask the question, why does Jesus need to call disciples? Why does he need to call followers? Certainly there were religious leaders at the time who worshiped Yahweh, men of incredible knowledge and wisdom and understanding. They were trained, they were educated, they were influential. Many of them were wealthy. They were poised, good at talking to people. Why is it that Jesus can't just saddle up to them and start his new mission? Why does he need to call other people? By contrast, Matthew and the others he calls, they're none of the things the other guys are. They're not educated. They're not wealthy. Maybe Matthew is, right? But and not only are they not as qualified, many of them have like some serious character issues, right? So why would Jesus call someone like Matthew? What is he looking for in a guy like that? What is he looking for in his disciples? I want to talk to you about calling. As far as I can tell, there are three different calls that will be placed on our lives. The first, I'll call a universal call. This is a call that goes out to all of humanity to be reconciled to God. In this sense, God is calling everyone to be restored into a relationship with him. The second is a general call. When we've been reconciled to God, now we take on a general call to live in a way that alerts the rest of the world of the God who saves. We're all supposed to do this, regardless of what your career is, regardless of what your age is, regardless of what your background is. You are all called, once you've been reconciled to God, to now speak to the rest of the world, announce and demonstrate, right? The good news of the gospel. And then there's a special call. And the special call is for the chosen few. It's the call to give up everything in your life for the work of the kingdom. Whatever you might have pursued, whatever you thought you wanted to be when you were a child, when I was 8, I wanted to be president. I watched a video of John Kennedy, thought that guy seems to be interested in helping people. Whatever it is that you might have planned for your life, this special call says, I'm going to put all that aside. And I'm going to do the work of the kingdom. Doesn't make sense. Didn't make sense for Matthew. Probably doesn't make sense for you. Still, Jesus might be calling you. So that's what I want to talk about today is that third call. But because it doesn't apply to everybody in the room, I want to kind of wrap this in its context. I want to tell you a story and then help you understand why Jesus might be calling these disciples in the first century. So let's start here. Shepherds and sheep. God's model of leadership in the Bible is best demonstrated with the visual of the shepherd. Again and again, we read about shepherds. It's the most frequent career of the leaders that God calls. I don't know if you've ever stopped to consider Abel was a shepherd, but Abraham, the father of the nations, was a shepherd. Jacob was a shepherd. Joseph and all of his brothers were shepherds. Moses was a shepherd. His successor, Joshua, was a shepherd. David was a shepherd, right? And Jesus calls himself the good shepherd. And shepherds are concerned more than anything else with the needs of their flock. They'll do anything to satisfy the needs of their flock. I said this earlier. If you imagine sheep in Israel or ancient Israel, it's not like imagining sheep in Ireland. They don't live on like lush green pastures. Sheep are animals of the desert. They live in the southern region of Israel where there's almost no grass and you have to walk very far to find it. And it's the shepherd's responsibility to make sure his flock is safe when they get to the grass, to find water for them. It might take days. He might be sleeping on the ground. But it's the shepherd's responsibility to satisfy the needs of the flock and then to protect the flock from predators, right? From enemies. And here's what's interesting about shepherds. Shepherds don't lead from the front. They lead from the center. The shepherd gathers the sheep to him so that they're close enough to hear his voice and know that they're safe. And the tools of a shepherd, the first one is the sling. The sling is used to keep the sheep near the shepherd in the center. So if a sheep are kind of a wandering, clumsy bunch, and so if a sheep wanders away, the shepherd will take out his sling. They actually use like carved out 2-liter bottles today. If you ever go to Israel and you see the Bedouin people, they're using, it's very interesting. But David didn't have 2 liters. The shepherds will use a sling to throw a rock on the other side of a sheep, and it'll startle the sheep back to the flock. So the reason David has a sling to defeat Goliath is because he's a shepherd. But the other tool they have is a staff. And the staff is used for defense. It's never used for discipline. The staff is used to protect the flock, not to strike the flock, right? It's for the sheep to fend off wild animals. So there's a scene when Moses is instructed, somewhere in the book of Numbers 16, he's instructed to speak to the rock so that water would come out for the people, right? And what does he do? He strikes it, right? And his punishment is, because he got angry at the people, he's frustrated at them for complaining, his punishment is he doesn't get to enter the promised land. He violated the code of the shepherd. The shepherd doesn't strike the flock. He doesn't turn it on the animals. This is God's model for leadership in the Bible. David says, "The Lord is my shepherd." The beginning of Psalm 23 there. So I want to ask this question. Who are the shepherds of Israel? Who is leading Israel in the first century? When Jesus is calling disciples, who is leading the worship of God in Israel, in Jerusalem, in the temple? It's a group of people called the Sanhedrin. They're led by the chief priest. They're responsible for temple worship, made up mostly of Sadducees, one like Jewish sect in the first century, some other Pharisees kind of sprinkled in there. But these are the people who are in charge of worship. And they're living like these extravagantly wealthy lives. They're living in palatial mansions, very large. We have some recreations of these that have been found by archaeologists in David's city. They're drinking bottles of wine that are like $10,000 a bottle in today's dollars, in the midst of a city where everybody is like, you know, they're dying under the oppression of Roman taxation. And the shepherds of Israel are getting rich. So I want to talk about what Jesus seems to think about how they're doing their job. And I want to turn to a familiar story to do that. In the book of Matthew, we read about this moment when it's the first Sunday of Passover and Jesus enters Jerusalem. He enters by way of the Mount of Olives. And as he comes to the Mount of Olives, there's a donkey waiting for him. And he climbs on this donkey and the people start like cheering and celebrating, right? And at the time, because this is Passover, Jerusalem is a city of like at best 50,000 people in the first century. But Josephus, the Jewish historian, says that number's more like 2 million or more during the feast of Passover. So all of these people have gathered to celebrate the Passover. And as Jesus comes walking in, they're waving palm branches. You know that story. And I don't want to get too spun out here, but rumors have begun to circulate that maybe Jesus is more than just a prophet. Maybe he's the Messiah that they've been waiting for. And the religious leaders aren't sure what they think about this because he poses a great threat to the systems that are in place. Well, Jesus comes down the Mount of Olives and then back up onto the Temple Mount. And there's a scene recorded in Matthew 21. I'm going to read verses 12 and 13 here. It's going to sound familiar to some of you. Here it is. Jesus entered the temple courts and he drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the temples of the money, he overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. So imagine you are a Jew in the first century, and maybe you're a Jew from northern Israel, maybe you're a Jew from outside of Israel, but imagine you're a Jew and you're traveling to Jerusalem for Passover to offer sacrifice in the temple. And you know, maybe if you're a Jew outside of Israel, this is a once in a lifetime trip. And you've got your family with you and you have your children and your kosher animals that you're gonna offer for sacrifice. And you're coming into Jerusalem for Passover. And when you arrive, you encounter this scene of like tremendous chaos. And there are people everywhere. There are animals everywhere. There's like, you know, animal droppings everywhere. The city is just overrun with people. It's pandemonium. It's this crazy scene. And it's exciting, right? Because it's a religious celebration. And you are going to participate this year with your children. What could be more special, right? So when you arrive, you move toward the Temple Mount and you're just caught up in everything that's happening. Your family is so excited. Your children are so excited to see the temple. And as you move toward the Temple Mount, someone sees you with your family and they notice the animals following behind you. They pull you aside. They say, hey, I got to tell you some news. You're going to want to know this. And they say, you know, the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and the temple leaders, they're not allowing you to bring your own kosher sacrifice. You can't bring your own animal anymore. These tables are set up so that you can go sell your animal and then buy a temple-raised sacrifice, right? Grass-fed, grass-finished, something like that. You have to buy our sacrifice now. And when you approach these tables, you're offered like a fraction of what your animal is worth. And the temple sacrifice is outrageously overpriced. You're just kind of caught in this moment of confusion and you start doing the math in your head and you're like, this isn't gonna happen. I don't have enough money. I can't sell my animal and buy animals. I'm gonna have to go back to my wife and my kids and tell them that we're not going to the temple, that we have to turn around and walk home. There's this like feeling of what just happened? What is happening here? This isn't right. This isn't fair. This system has been put in place by the Sanhedrin. They're supposed to be the shepherds of Israel. They're supposed to be caring for the people and they are lining their pockets through this series of exploitation, the system of exploitation. Or maybe you aren't a Jew. Maybe you're a foreigner. Maybe you're an outsider. You're from a distant land, but you've heard rumors about a God in Israel. And this God is different from other gods. This God welcomes everyone. This God doesn't allow you to worship other gods because he says he's the only God. This God's not geographic like most gods are in the ancient world, but he's everywhere. And usually you're not a person who needs religion as a crutch. But there's something about the what ifs of this story that kind of hooks you. What if it's true? What if it's real? What if there's a God who created me in his image? And so against your better judgment, you save some money and you head to Jerusalem. And you plan to be there. If you're going to be there, you're going to be there at the most important time of the year. You plan to be there for Passover. You know enough to know you're going to have to buy a sacrificial animal when you get there, but you don't have Jewish denarii. You have some foreign currency, so you're going to have to exchange your currency, right? Fortunately, some money changers have set up tables near the gate of the temple so that you can go exchange your currency. How convenient. And as you approach, you start to hear them mentioning the exchange rate to other people, and you can't believe your ears. This is absurd. They're offering pennies on the dollar of your currency. If you exchange your currency, you'll barely have enough to pay the temple tax, but you'll have no money to get home. What are you going to do? But maybe this God will provide. Maybe this God will take care of you. Maybe this God will be your shepherd. So you buy a temple animal, exchange your currency, buy a temple animal. You move into, this is an artist recreation of, sorry, would you go back to just that? Yeah, this is an artist creation of the recreation of the temple in the first century. And what you can see here is kind of like, you know, you have these outer protective walls, and then you have the courtyard of the Gentiles, which is like this giant plaza on both sides of the temple itself. This front room of the temple would be where you'd offer sacrifices, and then that tall terraced building in the back would be the most holy place where the chief priest would go once a year. But you move through the temple gates and you approach, you have your kosher animal now, your temple-raised animal, and you approach the place of sacrifice. Just as you're about to enter the temple from the court of the Gentiles, and you look above your head and there's a sign. It's called the Soreg inscription. Archaeologists have found this stone. And it reads these words: "No outsider, no foreigner shall enter the protective enclosure around the sanctuary, and whoever is caught will have only himself to blame for his ensuing death." And your heart just sinks. You aren't wanted here. You aren't welcome here. Apparently, this God that you've heard so much about is only interested in your money. And this whole scene is a con. But just like the Jew, what are you going to do about it? You're a nobody here. The people in charge of worship, they're the somebodies. They're the shepherds of Israel, and they are robbing the people. They are stealing from the people, and there is nothing that anybody can do about it. And so you turn to walk away from the Temple Mount, sort of dejected and discouraged, when all of a sudden you start to hear some commotion. You start to hear like some raised voices, and you notice all the chief priests are very identifiable by their outfit. All of the priests and the chief priests, they're off to the side and they're watching this scene unfold. And there's a man, and he's angry. He's not angry the way that most people are angry, but he's very upset, and he has this like measure of intensity about him. And he walks up to these money changers, and he walks over up to these people selling animals, and he begins throwing over their tables. And he says, "It is written, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." Whew, that's quite a scene. In those few words, Jesus is saying a lot more than he's saying. He's actually using an ancient technique called like hinting or something like that. He's referring to a couple places in the Old Testament. He's using just a few words to refer to the context around it because he knows the audience and the Sanhedrin will also know the context. It's like theological jujitsu or something. It's the layer of meaning beneath the surface layer, right? The first one's in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 56. Check this out. I'm going to start with verse 6. Look what this says. It's so incredible. "And foreigners," outsiders, "and foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord, to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and who hold fast to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." Isaiah writes this, the word of the Lord. But then he goes on, verse 10, "Israel's watchmen," Israel's leaders, Israel's shepherds, "Israel's watchmen are blind. They all lack knowledge. They are mute dogs that cannot bark. They lie around and dream. They love to sleep. They are dogs with mighty appetites. They never have enough. They are shepherds who lack understanding. They all turn to their own way. They seek their own gain. Come, each one cries, let me get wine. Let us drink our fill of beer, and tomorrow will be like today or even far better. Imagine you're that foreigner and you're hearing this confrontation. Foreigners are allowed in this house of prayer. It's Israel's watchmen that are corrupt. The second one's in the book of Jeremiah. So that was a house of prayer for all nations. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 1. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Ready? Stand at the gate of the Lord's house and there proclaim this message. Where is Jesus right now? He's standing at the gates of the temple of the Lord, right? Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your ancestors forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which bears my name, and say, we are safe to do these detestable things? Has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord. And he says, go now to the place in Shiloh where I first made a dwelling for my name and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. We got to go back a little bit further in the Old Testament to understand this reference. But in the book of 1 Samuel, the people build there's a tabernacle built before that in Shiloh for God. But in the book of 1 Samuel, there is this battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. And the high priest at the time, the chief priest at the time, was a man named Eli. And Eli was a good man, but he wasn't a great father. And Eli had two sons named Hophni and Phinehas, who were both priests, but they were not good men. They were wicked and corrupt, and often I think there's a story about them keeping like all the finest meats for themselves. They were wicked men. Well, anyway, Hophni and Phinehas rush into battle with the Israelites, and the Israelites are losing. And so they say, let's go back to the Ark of the Covenant, or let's go back to the tabernacle in Shiloh. Let's get the Ark of the Covenant. It represents the presence of God. Let's bring that into battle with us, and we'll be victorious. This is their thinking. Can you understand the logic at least? But they bring the Ark into battle, and they're routed. The Ark is captured by the Philistines. Hophni and Phinehas both die that day. The same day when Eli hears the news, I think the story is he fell backwards in his chair off the city gate and dies. But Phinehas' wife is pregnant at the time, and she gives birth to a baby boy and names it Ichabod, which means the glory of the Lord has departed. So what's wrapped up in this scene about Shiloh is you were destroyed in battle there. God took everything away. You don't get to just like co-opt the presence of God and use it as a weapon in battle. Go now to the place in Shiloh, Jesus said, where I first made a dwelling for my name and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. While you were doing all these things, declares the Lord, I spoke to you again and again, but you did not listen. I called to you, but you did not answer. Therefore, what I did to Shiloh, I will now do to the house that bears my name, the temple you trust in, the place I gave to you and your ancestors. Jesus says a lot in those 12 or 13 words about a house of prayer and a den of robbers. And what's most important is the Sanhedrin knows what he's saying. They know what he's saying, right? One of the charges against him is he threatened to destroy the temple. In fact, in Mark's account, the very next verse, it's like Mark 11 or 12, the very next verse after that, you know, house of prayer, den of robbers thing is, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law went away and looked for a way to kill him. What is Jesus saying here? He's saying this system that you have in place is coming to an end. I will not allow you to treat these people like this any longer. This is not going to stand. Get used to different. This is that artist's recreation of the temple in the first century. And from slightly the same angle, nearly the same angle, this is what it looks like today. In 70 AD, the Roman general Titus will climb to the top of the Mount of Olives. They'll cut down every olive tree they can find, drag them to the Temple Mount, and set them on fire. And the temple will be burned to the ground. From 70 AD onward, that's the fall of Jerusalem, but from 70 AD onward, we never hear about the Sadducees again. We never hear about the Sanhedrin again. This system of sacrifice is over. This system of corruption is over. The temple is burned to the ground, but a whole new church is being birthed in the middle of it. And Jesus is calling these leaders and these disciples who are willing to lay down their lives for the flock in the same way that he was. Jesus needed new shepherds for Israel who would lead the flock like the shepherds of old. And some of them were underqualified. Some of them had checkered pasts. Some of them were a bad choice on paper. But they could hear the voice of the shepherd. They could hear his voice. So let's come back to the present day. If we can be honest, well, let's say it like this. There has never been a moment in your life or anyone's life that you know where there has been more opposition to Christianity and the teachings of Jesus in this country. Never. I'd say not even close. Just stating the facts. That's just that leaders define reality. I'm just defining reality, right? There's never been more opposition to the teachings of Jesus than there is today. And we have a growing number of ministry leaders, of shepherds, who seek their own gain. We have a growing number of ministry leaders who have compromised their theology. We have a growing number of leaders who have redefined sin, who have changed their position from what it was 5 years ago, who are leading massive churches. They're leaders who have been silent in the face of injustice. They've been silent about corruption, silent about sexual abuse, sometimes at the hands of church leaders. They've been silent about abortion. They've been silent about the sexualization of children. They've been silent about trafficking. They've been silent about murderous ideologies that are becoming mainstream. I'm just telling you what the landscape is. We have church leaders who are participating in the destruction of the way of Jesus. That's just a fact. But not everybody. There are some who found their spine. There are some who have stood firm. There are some who surrendered their lives to Jesus long ago, and they're not interested in picking it back up again. We need shepherds. We need people who are called to leave whatever it is they've been doing, however successfully they've been doing it, to say, I hear the voice of the shepherd calling, and I need to surrender my life for the work of the kingdom. And maybe we've spent too much time in churches focusing on that general call that we all are. We're a royal priesthood. Yes, we are. We are, you know, we're all commissioned to tell about Jesus. Yes, we are. But some of you are called to do more than that, like Matthew was. Some of you are called to give everything, and the rest of us can't make it unless you do. We need new shepherds to lead us forward. We need people to hear the voice of Jesus calling to them to leave everything behind. Are you aware of the empty pulpit crisis? There is a massive shortage of pastors. Children's pastors, youth pastors, worship pastors, lead pastors, missionaries. People aren't doing these things anymore. Who's going to carry the light into dark places? We need shepherds to hear the voice of Jesus. Seminary numbers are down. The numbers of those who say they're called to full-time ministry are way down. This is combined with a number of current pastors who are walking away from the ministry in record numbers. These numbers are skyrocketing because ministry is hard. Maybe some of them should walk away, but many of them are just tired. It's hard work. They say if you want to be a pastor, you need the wisdom of Solomon, the heart of a child, and the hide of a rhinoceros, I think it is. You need thick skin. But we need to ask the question, who will give up the plans that they have for their lives and accept God's call to full-time ministry? It doesn't apply to everybody in this room. It has to apply to some of you. It just has to. Who will stand in the gap for the people of God? Who will guide them and protect them? Who will teach them? Who will speak on their behalf to those who want to take advantage of them? Who will remain committed to the Bible as a source of truth? I believe with every bone in my body right now that God is calling somebody who's listening right now into ministry. I absolutely believe it. I already told you guys, I wanted to be a politician. My undergraduate degree is in political science and English, okay? I fought this for a long time. I'm not a fourth generation pastor. I love that David is. I'm not one. My dad spent most of my life in prison. I had a very traumatic childhood. I'm all of the wrong goods for this kind of a job. I promise you, I'm not saying this for effect right now. I'm telling you, I have nothing to offer the call of Jesus, nothing. But one time when I was a senior in college, I was a semester away from graduation, he called. And I said, I'll abandon it all if this is what you want me to do. Some of you might not feel like you were called, but in this moment, maybe the Spirit is stirring something inside of you. It's not me. If there's something that's like tugging at your heart, it's not me. That's the Spirit of God speaking to you and saying, would you give your life? Would you give your career? Would you walk out of your tax collector's booth to the bewilderment of everyone around you? And give your life for the sake of the kingdom. So maybe you're on the fence about what to do with your life, and this has been a possible option. Maybe you used to be in ministry. Maybe you were called, and for whatever reason, you put it on the shelf, and you've left it behind. Maybe like me, you just don't feel like you're adequate. God should probably choose somebody else who's a little more qualified. And maybe God is inviting you today with those three simple words. Come, follow me. At times we say things in churches like the Lord works in mysterious ways. Sometimes he works in not so mysterious ways. Like when you might be wondering if you're called to ministry and a pastor standing in front of you asking you to consider whether you're called to ministry. Not so mysterious, direct, unmistakable. We need you. We need the next generation of church leaders. We need a current generation. We need people. P.T. Barnum didn't get into the circus business until he was, 70 years old, 67, something like that? Didn't know anything about the circus until he was 70. Some of you might be older, but the call still goes to you. So if you feel something stirring inside of you, here's what I want to do. I want to offer a prayer of invitation to respond to this. And after that prayer, I'm going to invite anybody who feels like they might be called to ministry to come forward. And we're going to have Katie, our location pastor, is going to be down front here to talk to you. If you're at East, Todd's going to be in the front. If you're downtown, Josh or one of the other location pastors will be there in the front. If you are watching online, there's someone in the chat room we'd love to talk to you. If you're watching on TV 6 months from now, call our office. We want to talk to you. We want to help you navigate what it might mean to be called to ministry, to give everything away for the sake of the kingdom. So I'm going to pray and then I'm going to invite you forward. If you bow your heads, God, thank you so much that you have demonstrated how you want us to love one another by the way that you love us. And you've demonstrated how you want us to lead one another by the way that you lead us. You are our good shepherd, Lord. And some of us, you are calling to abandon our nets, to abandon our tax collector booths, our legal practices, our small businesses, our medical degrees. You're calling us to leave that behind and accept a call to full-time ministry. So Lord, I pray that today you would stir in the hearts of some people who are listening. Give them the courage to stand up and to walk forward, to stand up and say, I need to know more about this. God is moving and saying something to me and I need to know more. I pray this in your name, amen. So we're gonna pause here for just a minute, just a couple minutes. If you're okay with it, I'd ask you to just kind of sit quietly. AJ's just going to play the guitar, and I just want to create some space for people to respond. It might feel awkward for a second, but that's okay. I want to invite you to come forward. If you think God might be calling you to full-time ministry, don't let anything hold you back. I want to invite you to come forward and pray with Katie. About another 45 seconds. Stand with me. I'd love to just offer a benediction for us. To him who is able to do immeasurably more than we could ask or imagine, all glory, honor, and praise. Go in peace. We'll see you next week.